Je pense sans cesse à toi.
Hola, mis amigos, and welcome to The Four Top. It's a roundtable discussion of today's hot-button topics in food and beverage. I'm your host, Catherine Cole. Our first course of episode 18 will focus on sanctuary restaurants. Could the dining establishment bring social and political change to our nation? Next, we will talk about undocumented workers in the food industry. And for our final course, we will lighten up a bit and discuss the delights of Peruvian cuisine. Today in the studios of OPB, I'm joined by reporter Roxy De La Torre, who covers the immigration beat for OPB. Welcome, Roxy.
Hi, Catherine. How are you? Thanks for inviting me. I'm very excited to be here.
We're excited to have you. And Hannah Wallace, who writes for publications such as Vogue, Food and Wine, Modern Farmer, Travel and Leisure, and the New York Times.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And Peter Platt, an expert in social entrepreneurship, who owns the groundbreaking Peruvian restaurant Andina right here in Portland. Hello.
Hello. Thanks, Catherine.
Well, let's get started today with the subject of sanctuary restaurants. I walked into a bakery yesterday and I noticed a sign posted on the front door that said that people of all races, religions, and sexual orientations were welcome here. So what's going on with these signs? Hannah Wallace, you recently wrote about this trend in Civil Eats, so maybe you can start us off and explain what is a sanctuary restaurant?
Sure. So it's similar to the notion of sanctuary cities, but it's a little different because it's not just about immigration. So a lot of people are feeling afraid these days, not just undocumented immigrants, African-Americans, Muslim Americans, transgendered, and these people happen to be greatly represented in the restaurant industry. So back in January, a bunch of restaurants, all of whom were members of this organization called Restaurant Opportunity Centers United, came together and decided to publicly declare, we're going to be safe places for people of all nationalities, all ethnicities, all sexual orientations. And they came together and came up with this plan of calling themselves sanctuary restaurants, which basically means putting a sign in the window like that that says we're a safe place for everybody. I think it says a place at the table for everyone. And the sign that you're talking about is actually a sort of less formal thing that I've seen around Portland. I don't think that's actually officially a sanctuary restaurant, which is sort of run by ROC, this organization, Restaurant Opportunity Center. But it's the same idea. And it's like just sort of welcoming everyone, not just the people who work in the restaurant, but also diners, so that diners know that they're welcome in these places.
And so you get this vision of someone like running into the sanctuary restaurant, like you used to hear, you know, in the olden times of people running into a church so someone wouldn't arrest them or something. Actually, that's still the case. So have you heard of any examples of a sanctuary restaurant being called upon to save someone?
Or? No, I don't think it's that literal. It's more just, you know, to invite people to the restaurant. I mean, there's a lot of restaurants in Portland, for example, that probably already feel this way, but this is sort of an explicit welcoming. However, with this specific movement, sanctuary restaurants, ROC actually has been serving as a resource. And so both restaurant owners and to some extent diners and also employees have been contacting the people at ROC to get advice, like legal advice. And there was one case where a person who was harassed by a customer didn't know what to do, and they called ROC. So they're serving as a resource in that capacity. And in May, they're actually going to give out a text number where people can text. It's sort of like an instant rapid response thing. If you have something that happens to you in a restaurant, or if there's an employee who feels afraid because they think their boss is going to announce them to ICE immigration, you know, then they'll be able to have some sort of recourse. They can give instant advice via text.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And Catherine, I think it's very important to note that the term sanctuary for sanctuary restaurants doesn't promise, you know, that to keep undocumented workers safe from deportation. So it's very important to note that.
It does not promise that.
It does.
That's true.
Yeah. So I think like what they're trying to do is, especially for undocumented workers, is they give them legal response, you know, if something happened, if ICE, you know, for some reason show up there, they train their workers of what to do and about legal rights and things like that.
But I have read that if ICE comes to your restaurant, restaurant owners have been trained to know that you don't have to answer any questions. Has anyone heard of something like this happening? Peter, have you ever had this happen at your restaurant?
No. I think the Immigration Customs Enforcement has the jurisdiction to detain, right? That's their right to do so, but only in a situation where they have a warrant, right, or they have just cause. It's great to have resources, available legal counsel in order for not just employers but employees to know what their rights are. As a sympathetic business owner, we're a bicultural, institution. I'm a bicultural person. You're a bicultural family. So we have a lot of sympathy with the situation that some immigrant workers find themselves in from time to time, whether fairly or unfairly. First job really is to be a good employer, right? You comply with the law. But beyond that, going beyond that, offer a place of work that is safe and trusting and secure, because that's what employees need, particularly in the hospitality industry, in order to provide the kind of level of service and hospitality that our customers want to expect. So I think it's deeply ironic, kind of tragically ironic, that restaurants now may find themselves in the crosshairs, because restaurants are places that people go to feel better, right, about themselves and about their community. It's why you go out to enjoy a night of relaxation, food and drink. So I think restaurant owners and operators have an obligation to defend the industry. It's not just a legal issue. It's really about defending the fact that we're all about hospitality to begin with, and that restaurants should be that place for anyone, regardless of their background.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. This is Hannah again. I just wanted to say that when I wrote that article for Civil Eats back in January, there were 60 to 65 restaurants nationwide who were sanctuary restaurants. And again, this is just the official sort of with ROC United. But now there's 500. So I think it's really catching on. I think a lot of restaurants are just saying, you know what, this is an important issue for us. It's not just because we may or may not have undocumented workers who work here, or some people who work here, their family members are undocumented, but we want everyone in the community to feel that they can come in this restaurant as diners, and also all of our employees, we want them to feel safe.
I looked at that list, Hannah, online, and I saw all these restaurants in New York and California and Oregon and Washington, and I was thinking, well, these aren't states where people are feeling as threatened. What was interesting to me were states like Arkansas and Arizona and Georgia,
sure,
and Iowa and Idaho. And there are actually a lot of restaurants in Kentucky for some reason, which I thought was fantastic.
Yeah.
There was only one in South Carolina, which was kind of a bummer. And I would be interested to see how this movement grows and whether the restaurant industry can maybe start to, I don't know, make some change in some places where people are not
as welcoming. They get more press about this, I'm sure that will grow. I mean, I think it started to grow out of the members of ROC. ROC has been working on restaurant industries. They're an organization that helps increase wages and better working conditions in restaurants across the country. And so it probably started with the core group of ROC members. Mm-hmm. And so as more stories have been written about it, I'm sure more people are joining ROC and just signing on to the sanctuary restaurant movement, which really is just about putting a sign in your window and announcing to the public that you're a safe space.
But it's good, even if it is just a sign, to just make that declaration and kind of share that thought with people. Peter, can I put you on the spot for a
second? Sure.
Because I read that the National Restaurant Association is not behind this movement. So I was curious why that would be.
Yeah, I think, immigration policy, it touches on a lot of other background issues. It's hard to talk about just immigration policy in a vacuum without also talking about the labor market and, the slow pace of inflation and the ability of restaurant owners to, pass on additional charges through menu price increases. There's a whole lot of economic issues that underpin the real debate around immigration policy. And I think my interpretation of the restaurant lobby's position is that they're factoring those in. So as much as they've pushed for and supported quietly, in a way, comprehensive immigration reform, my understanding is they've also shied away from any support for a living wage, for example, things of that sort, because they take a strictly economic they tend to take a more strictly economic perspective. So as I was thinking about this conversation, the things that I wanted to highlight were, first, some of the facts, right? According to the latest statistics, anywhere from 10 to upwards of 20% of, kitchen workers in the United States are of an immigrant background, and a percentage of those probably are undocumented. Of course, the industry is concerned about this because that's a labor pool issue, right? This is an unavailable labor pool. If that's going to change, what's going to happen? What are we going to do to prepare for that? But that concern has been there for a while, and it's existed for at least, I was just counting them in my head, at least six other factors. So you have and bear with me here because this is important stuff to be talking about. You have an increased cost of living in urban areas. Right, which drives out low-skilled workers across many industries because they can't afford to live in a place like San Francisco or Seattle or even Portland now. They live on the urban periphery. It's more and more expensive to commute into work, so they go away, basically. There's also, at the same time, an increased demand for skilled kitchen labor because in those high-rent cities like Portland, there's a strong demand for restaurants. So all of a sudden, you've got a shortage, right, of skilled labor precisely the time that demand is peaking. Then you've got, a failure of the usual supply of skilled kitchen labor that would come from the domestic labor supply, and that's culinary schools. And culinary schools, frankly, are just a total ripoff, and they failed. They imploded. They've gone away. You know, there are very few of them left these days. And that then runs up against the issue then that restaurants are struggling with right now, which is another equity issue, which is the historic pay inequity between front of house and back of house, by which I mean service and kitchen labor. Mm-hmm. So, and that dynamic too often plays out against race and class lines within restaurants. And then you have, like I mentioned before, the low inflation environment because of low federal interest rates. So our ability to raise prices at the inflation level, basically to track inflation, is outpaced by the increase in wages now that we have to make up for. So we can't pass along the costs like we used to the customer. There has to be a fundamental reorganization of the restaurant business model. And the big issue, which I think everyone tends to dance around, is the fact that we're used to eating cheap food. That's just a reality.
Yeah.
We spend 15% of our take-home income in this country on average on food. And in Europe and other industrialized nations, it's easily double that. So cheap food is what keeps the lid on cheap labor. And that's an industry-wide phenomenon. That affects agriculture, that affects food packing, it affects restaurants. So restaurateurs now, I think, particularly in the fine dining category, are struggling to figure out, okay, with all this change going on, including immigration policy, what do we do, right? How do we react to that in a way that still allows us to serve our customers, treat our employees well, and make a living? So it's a really interesting time to be in the restaurant business. And I can't say I have a solution per se, but, it's important to have this discussion.
Well, we've already kind of moved into our next topic, which is undocumented labor in the food industry. So let's just keep going there. Peter, I want to get back to you with one more question, which is, this is probably difficult as a restaurant owner to answer, but how many of your peers, let's say, mm-hmm. are employing undocumented workers?
It's hard to say. I mean, I always put this in terms of a question that I ask myself, daily as an owner and operator, and also what our restaurant management team always asks is, are we being, first and foremost, good employers? And that starts with, as I said before, compliance with the law, right? And the law begins and ends with the I-9 form in this respect when it comes to worker document verification or worker verification. Do you have the proper paperwork to work? And you can go online and look at all of those things. And the letter of the law basically says, you have to have that paperwork in hand when you start work, and it's the owner's obligation to ask for it, receive it, and document that.
But wait, Peter, can I stop you?
Yeah, sure.
So if your I-9 paperwork looks reasonable and your photo ID looks reasonable, as an employer, you don't really need to ask any more questions than that, do you?
No, it's not our obligation to verify. I believe the federal policy that is being discussed at this point, there have been some bills in the federal government, some congressmen that are sponsoring to require that verification process. And how that occurs you know, both technically and also with respect to the law, with respect to privacy issues, et cetera, that's beyond my scope of knowledge and competence. But I know it is an issue that is being actively talked about. You know, it's not just the restaurant industry that's potentially impacted by all of this. Agriculture is even more so, food packing, construction, you know, some of the lower wage work in the healthcare industry. We're all drawing from a similar labor pool mm-hmm. when it comes to this. You know, Danny Meyer, who's New York restaurateur, considered, you know, the preeminent operator of our generation, you know, he made his name not by reinventing anything, but just by very elegantly articulating the fact that if you treat your employees well, if you treat your vendors well, if you treat your community well, right, and the customers, you're going to do okay, right? It'll all sort itself out in the end. And you'll put yourself in a position where you're not necessarily inclined to want to break the law, because there are not a lot, but a few unscrupulous operators out there who don't check and don't verify because they
oh, come on. You know, A few?
I don't know if it's a few. Again, I don't. I know my business. I don't know anybody else's.
Oh, wait, hold on. Yeah. I got to turn to Roxy here. Roxy, from your understanding reporting on this, how many workers in the restaurant industry, you probably don't have exact numbers, but when you're out there in the field, how many people are working in the food industry and the restaurant industry who don't have their papers, are undocumented?
Well, I do have some research. I did some research, and I was just checking the Pew Research Center, and then they say like 11 million people are undocumented in this country, and 11% of them, they work in the food and in preparation, serving in the food industry. So they do present papers, but most people know that those papers are... They know or they don't know. I don't know how good they are, but, you know, people who use those papers and then they work in the industry, in the restaurants.
So, Roxy, when you're out in the field, do you speak to people who are working in restaurants? I'm thinking that they are visible to the public because they're kind of interfacing with the public. Even if they're in the kitchen, often you can see them back there. Are they worried that the authorities are going to come after them? What's it like right now?
They are. There's fear among the immigrant community, for sure. I was contacted like 2 weeks ago by a restaurant owner, and he's like, hey, Roxy, could you come and speak with our employees? Because they are afraid. They just saw the immigration outside of the restaurant, and they are afraid. They don't know what to do. Could you please, because he was kind of friend with me, and so I went then and I talked to them and I was asking them, like, you know, how are you living now? And then they were like, oh, you know, we don't even want to go to work. We don't even want, you know, if we are here working, we don't even know if we want to be outside, you know. So things like that is happening not only in the food industry. I mean, farm workers, like you were talking, Peter, you know, this, and that is affecting, it's like... La cadena. Mm-hmm. It's a chain reaction. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. it's you know, start like from farms to food packing to, you know, people in the restaurants. It goes everywhere. People are afraid. But the sanctuary movement that is going on, the sanctuary restaurants are helping them, like workers. In that particular restaurant I went, they had that sign, and they felt more comfortable. They felt more secure there, and especially because they said that they received training, and part of the training is like they talk to the owners, and they say, like, you know, if immigration ICE agents show up in your restaurant, you have the right to ask for papers. Mm-hmm. So, and
like
for,
Peter was saying, you need to have a warrant, right?
You need to have a warrant. And then the owners have the right, if they don't have the warrant, they have the right to say, you know, you cannot go inside my restaurant. So they were saying that they received that kind of information, so that they felt more kind of like in peace and safer to go to work. From those kind of restaurants. So.
You know, it's so interesting what you were saying earlier, Peter, about how we just – maybe we all just need to be willing to pay more for food. It seems like maybe we don't need comprehensive immigration reform. We just need comprehensive price of food reform.
Yeah, it's – again, there's been a lot of – I think the the voice of reason or leadership within the restaurant industry, I admire Danny Meyer quite a bit because he has taken a stance, right? And granted, he operates in New York at a very high level. Average check is very high. So he has a very stable labor pool where he's, very smartly, he and his organization have talked with everyone involved and said, look, this is a professional career and we want to treat you like professionals, right? We want to pay as much attention, if not more, to the people behind food as we do to our ingredients, right? So why shouldn't we pay more for that, mm-hmm. right? It's just in his mind, it's treating the people who choose to work in our industry as professionals.
Yeah.
And it's on that note, fundamentally, that he feels, and he's talked openly about it. He's like, when you tip somebody, he's like, you're not treating them as a professional, right? You pay somebody what they're worth. And for the work that they do, the knowledge they have, et cetera. And I think personally, I like that. I like that approach because in this city, there was just a piece in Willamette Week about that.
Which is a local weekly newspaper.
Local weekly newspaper. That a lot of people, a lot of my employees, this is their profession. This is their chosen profession. They make a good living doing this. But it takes some time to think and consider how do you create that experience? How do you create that package? How do you make it a good business proposition?
So, okay. So Peter and Hannah, it seems like you're saying a living wage may be a solution to the problem that many of our restaurants are staffed by undocumented workers because they're kind of the only ones willing to put up with pay that's so low. But Hannah, you and I have both covered the wine industry. Mm-hmm. We're certainly familiar with the concept of harvest. We've been out in the field. Just the act of harvesting food is so seasonal and the pay is terrible. And that's something that's always been done by migrant workers. I don't see how that's ever going to change. Do either of you?
No. And I actually don't think that that's the solution necessary. I still think we need immigration reform in terms of the restaurants. I mean, I think obviously it's great to raise wages for all restaurant workers, whether they're undocumented or not. But it still doesn't solve the problem of we have a huge number. We have over 1 million people in this country in the restaurant industry who are undocumented. So they're still going to be undocumented and paid more. So I don't think that's going to solve anything. But for the harvest and farm workers, there was a story recently, and now I can't remember where I read it, but it was about a farm in California that is a garlic farm, and they couldn't get, because there's this idea that no one who is not a farm worker is going to want to do this labor because it is so difficult and it is really grueling work. But he raised the wages to like $15 an hour, I think. Do you know what story I'm talking about? And suddenly, guess what? He had all these people who wanted to work. I think partly it's what we were talking about wages. I don't know how much the wineries are paying, and I think some wineries pay $50 an hour maybe, or, I'm not even sure really, but I think, I just think that it has to do with money. I think that if we pay better wages, we'll get people who maybe thought they weren't cut out for this job, but in fact, if they're paid better, they would try it.
And it's interesting because I recently talked to a farmer, and he said he did the same thing. He raised the wages, but he hired five people who were willing to do their work, but they lasted 2 days.
I hear this all the time in the wine industry. They're not willing to. The work is hard and
right.
It's detailed, and you have to get it right. And
yeah, that's what they say. I hire them, and I say okay, here's the work, and then they 2 days later they say this is too much for us, and then they left.
And these were obviously not migrant workers.
These were local yokels. Yes.
Well,
yes.
I know you don't want to talk about farm workers too much in this episode because you might be doing it again in the future, but there was a great story on Civil Eats today, actually, which was talking about how maybe more farms, more agricultural entities in the U.S. are going to start hiring using the H-2A visa program, which is a legal way of hiring immigrant farm workers, but it's more costly. And I'm not sure. I think there's some ins and outs with it. But if anyone listening wants to read more about that, there was a great story in Civil Eats today by Christina Cook on that subject.
Post that on our social media so people can check that out.
Yeah, I think, when I sort of sit back and reflect on and everything that's being shared here, the word that keeps coming up for me is respect. And it's about respect in this case, I think, for work, for the work that's done. Because as you pointed out, it's hard work in a lot of these settings, very hard work. And we should respect the people doing it, whether or not they have an immigrant background, irrespective of that, there needs to be an acknowledgement and understanding and respect for the work. And I think, again, from just an employment standpoint, if you have it, if you approach it that way and you respect the work and the worker, you're going to pay people well, right? And that in and of itself addresses the economic issues that underpin this issue, right? Because immigration policy is all about economics. It really is. And the solution is going to be economic. Yes, there is a policy piece to it. Whether that's amnesty or work visas, who knows where we're going to come down on that. But fundamentally, it's about respecting workers. And that's what we can do as employers. That's our choice. We can choose to do that, right, individually. We can be a good employer. So irrespective of policy issues, sometimes those things are just out of our hands, right? We can add our voice to it and have these important discussions. And hopefully that finds its way into the policy environment.
And for our final course, let's move on to the sensory pleasures of Peruvian cuisine, a blend of indigenous European, Asian, and African influences. Peruvian food can be simultaneously stick-to-your-ribs satisfying, jet-setting, exotic, and chic. Roxy De La Torre, maybe you can start us off. What are some things that we all need to know about the food of Peru?
Well, as a Peruvian, I have to say that Peruvians, we love our food. And, Peruvian food is a mix of flavors because Peru is a country of many cultures who settle in Peru and they brought their own cuisine and their own culture, so we mixed. And we went through so many social and political hardships, and especially 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I think like what unites us was our cuisine. So I think that is what means Peruvian food, like union and sharing. And we love to talk about our food. We love that when people eat and, they taste the flavors and they're like, oh, my God, this is, I never tried this one. And it was very famous for a long time in South America. But I feel like in recent years, thanks to restaurants like, they open internationally, like Andina here in Portland, they brought the flavors of Peru, especially the flavors from the Andes, mm-hmm. where I am from. I remember 15 years ago when I got here, I didn't have those flavors. And suddenly Andina showed up. And then I, was just trying. It was new, novel Andina food. But if you taste the flavors, you get transported to Peru, mm-hmm. and especially to the Andes of Peru.
Mm-hmm. Roxy, can I back you up? What were you referring to when you spoke of the hardships 10 years ago?
Well, we, for 10 years, for a decade, more or less, we had the Shining Path tourism. I don't know if you heard about that.
But particularly during the 80s, actually.
In the 80s, yeah.
80s, early 90s.
Yeah, 80s and 90s. We have tourism. There was, the economy was really bad. I remember when I was growing up, we have to do lines to buy food, to buy milk. And they were selling just to mothers when they see one or two kids, you can get one can of milk. Those kind of stuff, they were going through, for a decade, I say.
Yeah, almost close to two decades. I think it was during that time that Peruvian society and the economy was in upheaval, soaring inflation, you know, political instability, the Shining Path, to this day actually is still the most, the bloodiest, and is classified as a terrorist organization, terrorist organization in the Western Hemisphere. And, you know, the counterinsurgency killed scores of Peruvians as well. The government, kind of went to war with the Shining Path, and so innocent people were caught in the crossfire. It was pretty nasty. And I think coming out of that, Peru, as Roxy was saying, was looking for a symbol of kind of reconstruction, if you will, right? What could we take pride in? And, you know, Peru's soccer team, every now and then does something cool, but it's always sort of like flirting with success. So food became kind of this it became a rallying symbol, a rallying cry for the country. And to this date, it's become the most powerful marketing tool that Peru has. Peru has historically had a pretty good tourism industry, and that's grown now again. And a big part of that has become gastronomic tourism. The top 50 restaurants were just announced the other day, and two of the top 10 now are in Lima, Central and Maito. Right,
and three are the 50 most. Yeah,
exactly. So it's finally landed on the world stage, and in a way that is really proving to take a lot of pride in. The most famous person in Peru these days is definitely Gaston Acurio, right? Who's kind of a superstar. He's a chef, and he was the one I think who can rightly be credited with helping start the food movement in Peru. He came from a wealthy family. His father packed him off to study law in Madrid, and he took his tuition money and hopped over to France and went to school at the Cordon Bleu, became a chef, brought his wife back, German wife back, and they started a little French restaurant in Lima. His dad was furious, but he's like, okay, fine, I'll help you out with this. And his dad was a former prime minister, lots of connections, et cetera. But they were cooking French food for a long time until Gaston kind of woke up and said, why am I doing this? There's this incredible bounty, this incredible oral history of cuisine in Peru. I'm going to start cooking really high-end Peruvian food. And because he helped translate an oral tradition into something a little bit more classy, right, more presentable for the jet set, and his pals then went into this too. At first it was kind of an upper class thing because they had the money to send their kids overseas to study at, Parisian cooking schools, or et cetera. But then it became this groundswell of things where Peru right now, it is the coolest thing to be a chef. If you're a cook, if you're in a restaurant industry, that is the coolest thing. And so you have this huge national response, and it's totally unlike anywhere else I've been, in Lima in particular, where in the big festival they have down there, Mistura, every year. It's giant. It's crazy. And the degree to which it's supported by the government, the degree to which they're integrating it now into their land use policy and agricultural policy, it's they're ahead of us right now. And that's what's remarkable. Peru is actually kind of helping lead the charge.
Remind me the names of his restaurants, Gaston Acurio's.
Well, the first one is Astrid y Gaston.
And La Mar,
is the ceviche.
Okay. I went there when I was in Lima.
In Lima, yes. Yeah. So that was his expansion concept. And they opened also in San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
I think they've got one in Miami now and several around the world in, Mexico City and Caracas and Sao Paulo, places like that. And so it's becoming now an export, right? Peruvian cuisine is an export. It's a legitimate export. And it's kind of cool just to see that happen over the course of just 10, 15 years, right?
Yes,
it hasn't been going on for very long.
Adding to that, to what you said, Peter, Lima has this 70 cooking schools now. You don't see that in the world. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
No.
And like you said, Peru is trying to push the gastronomy. The cuisine is very rich, and another restaurant, the number 5th on the list is Central, and the chef at Central is Virgilio Martinez.
Mm-hmm.
And he was elected by all the chefs in the world the number 1 chef.
Wow! Mm-hmm.
So, and the way that I was just checking a documentary about him, like what he does is like he goes to the Andes and see how people, native people, cooks there, like, you know, how they cook the potatoes, for example. And then he tries to bring it to, like, a new, more infusion of wine, in a higher end. But still, you can, you know, if you try, you can taste like you are in the Andes in the moment.
It's it's what he calls vertical cuisine. In fact, he arranges his menu by verticality. It's like, this is 15,000 feet, right? And here's
elevation.
The dishes. Elevation, yeah. And so, and it's because Peru has that much to offer when they talk about, you know,
products
and, you know, the eating local and the 100-mile radius and all the things that, you know, in the high-end restaurant world started, funny enough, in a place of scarcity in Scandinavia, right? There isn't a lot of food diversity there. But, you know, Rene Redzepi at Noma really initiated this. And this is the number one restaurant in the world for, I think, 3 or 4 years running. It was kind of the trendsetter. It started really at a high end, at sort of the world cuisine level. It really legitimized the whole idea of cooking with ingredients that you yourself forage within 100 or 200 miles of your restaurant. And so that has taken a foothold now in Peru. And Peru is like, oh, awesome, because we've got like 85 of the 100 or so biozones in the world, right? We got a lot of stuff we can work with. And so it's you know, as a chef, it's an exciting place to be.
Just potatoes, you know, like the number one products that we have in Peru, like we have 50,000 kind of potatoes.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just quinoa also that, you know, we have here internationally, like, yeah.
Roxy, I'd love to get back to something you mentioned earlier. You talked about how the food has really brought so many people together. And could you talk a little bit about, I mean, this kind of ties back to our earlier topics, that Peru has, over history, been a place that people move to from other parts of the world. So can you tell us a little bit about the different types of people who live in Peru, the different ethnicities, and how they've come together to build this cuisine?
Well, we have people that are from all over the world, you know. And one thing that I was just talking to a friend the other day, and he's like, oh, so you guys have Japanese food? Do you have, like, Chinese food? And actually in Peru, we don't have that. We have a fusion, and we put the name Chifa, which, because we have many Asian immigrants in Peru, and then they mix their cuisine with Peruvian cuisine, and now it came Chifa, which is and that's one example of, like, all the cultures that they come, and then we create our own Peruvian version of that.
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, the chifas are great. They're everywhere, and they're served in sort of the traditional, what you would see if you went to Chinatown in San Francisco, right? It's these big dining halls. They look very much the same. And it's a Cantonese Peruvian fusion, but it's served in that traditional Chinese environment. And it's considered its own cuisine, yeah. Chifa.
Exactly.
Yeah, vamos a hacer. Ah, vamos a chifa.
And I think many people don't realize the celebrity chef Nobu Matsuhisa, the cuisine he cooks is Peruvian Japanese. And he's known all over the world, of course. Are there other countries that have kind of contributed to the Peruvian cuisine?
Yeah, I mean, the immigration patterns in South America were very much similar to the ones here in the United States. A lot of Italian immigrants. In fact, at the turn of the last century, there were more pasta factories in Lima than there were in the United States at that time, because just so many immigrants had arrived, Italian immigrants. So they had a big impact on the food. In the colonial period, a lot of royalty and aristocracy moved to Lima because it was the center of the Spanish Empire in South America, a very wealthy city, a lot of gold and silver flowing through there. So you had all the marquises and marquesas and everyone who wanted to live there and enjoy that aristocratic life, and they wanted to eat well. So the food culture really kind of developed around that. But you have African immigrants, of course. You know, unfortunately, Peru did have slavery at that time, and so there was an influence from particularly West African culture. And a lot of Chinese and Japanese immigrants who came for the same reasons they came here. They built the Transandine Railroad and fished the coast of Peru. And so they all chose to stay for the most part, you know, but there are German immigrants and Scottish immigrants. It's as diverse a country as we are. But because it's an older country, they've had a longer time to sort of marinate together all those different ingredients, right? And so there's more of that kind of fusion, if you will.
I love that.
Yeah.
Hannah, as someone who's not Peruvian by birth, I'm curious, when you were down there, what struck you about the cuisine?
Well, it's funny. Before I say that, I was just thinking when you said all the different cultures. When, I can't remember, was it, what's the really high elevated town? Not Lima.
Cusco.
Mm-hmm. I was in Cusco, and I remember we had lunch or dinner at a Swiss restaurant there. Mm-hmm. There was a little Swiss place. I think I had muesli, and I was like, this is so weird. Like, I'm in Cusco, and I'm having muesli.
You're
there
in
the
Alps.
Cows everywhere and pictures of the Swiss Alps. Anyway, I just love the food there. I mean, everywhere we ate a lot of just sort of modest places along the Sacred Valley. A lot of seafood, as I recall. I did not have, what is that, llama?
Mm-hmm. Alpaca.
No. Uh-huh. My mom wanted me to try that, and I said no. I'm not a vegetarian, but I draw the line at furry, cute animals, so I didn't have any of that. But quinoa and lots of avocados, too.
Did you have any cuy, the guinea pig?
I didn't. I know I should
have. Oh,
you
missed out. Yeah.
It's so good. My childhood friend had guinea pigs as pets, and we used to dress them up. And so, no, yeah. I would not
eat
one.
You know, Hannah, I am from Cusco, and guinea pigs in Cusco are the best.
I need to get over my fear of eating cute furry animals.
Hannah, it's very interesting because I went to Cusco a couple of years ago, and I think I went to the Swiss place.
Oh, you know what I'm
But
doing.
The ingredients in the muesli, they have quinoa, kiwicha.
Oh.
So, like I said, many cultures moved to Peru, even recently, even right now. But the culture in Peru is so strong and so proud of their cuisine, that they will always going to find a way to mix. Okay, you want to make it into the market in Peru,
yeah.
You have to incorporate Peruvian
ingredients.
Yeah.
That's cool. I didn't realize that.
That was a very tasty third course. I think we can move on to our dessert course now, in which we each share a little something we've been enjoying this week. I will go first, since we were just talking about Cusco. As I was thinking about our last topic, I remembered that a friend of mine from high school, who's a professional photographer, his name is Adam Weintraub, so hi, Adam, if you're listening, he lives part-time down in Peru, and started a museum and bar in Cusco called Museo de Pisco. So you can go there and learn all about Pisco, which is, I believe, a type of brandy.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you can do flights and tastings, and you can also just hang out and enjoy being at a bar. And it seems like a really cool place, so I think I need to go down there check it out.
That's awesome, yeah.
Roxy, did you bring anything to share with us all today?
Well, actually, 2 days ago, I was walking into an organic grocery store, and I saw mangoes, and I grab one and I smell it, and it transported me to Peru. I'm kidding, you know. And then I was like, what? And I check, it was Peruvian mangoes.
Wow.
So I was like, wow, I can't believe I smell other kinds of mangoes, and I never get that, you know, that feeling. But so if you find a Peruvian mango, try a Peruvian mango, and you will be transported to Peru.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to do that this weekend. Yum, you just made me hungry. Hannah, how about you?
This has nothing to do with Peru, but I'm totally obsessed right now with Joshua McFadden's soon-to-be-published cookbook, which he wrote in conjunction with Martha Holmberg. It's called Six Seasons. It's coming out in May, and I got a press copy, so I've been using it for about a month now. But he's just like the master of the vegetable dishes and salads, and so I've been really enjoying recipes like the Roman candle farro salad with roasted carrots, and I made a pasta dish the other night with Swiss chard and pine nuts that my husband and everyone else seemed to really enjoy, and it's just a lot of really great. It's all organized by season too, so it's really easy to go with the farmer's market or your CSA share, which will be arriving soon.
That's
really
cool.
I think we'll be talking to Martha in an upcoming
episode,
because I can't wait to hear what the other two seasons are. You know, the six seasons.
Yeah, now I should remember that, right? I'm totally obsessed with it, but I haven't read it in its entirety, so I can't tell you what that is.
And for our listeners, Josh McFadden is a chef here in Portland.
Thank you.
And he's the chef at Ava Jeans and Roman Candle,
he's not at Roman Candle anymore, but he and his partner opened a restaurant called Tusk.
Yes.
And he's not the chef at Tusk, but he's the owner, so.
Yes.
And I've only been there once, so I can't say much about it, but I love Ava Jeans.
Wonderful. That sounds really good. And Peter, did you bring some dessert for us?
Yeah, I'll integrate a little bit of the what Roxy and Hannah shared, which is that if we're looking at salads, we're looking at proven ingredients, one of the projects that we've been working on for many years at the restaurant has been to increase the local supply of Peruvian ingredients here in Oregon, right? And so we've partnered with a farm down in Corvallis, where my parents are from, and they're great. They're seed specialists, and they've been working diligently to adapt these Peruvian varietals to the climate and soil here in Oregon. And so we finally are starting to harvest some of that stuff, very small quantities. But it's all vegetables, really cool things, mostly root crops, as well as some of the hot peppers, the ajíes. But one of the ones you ought to tell Josh McFadden about is called yacón. And it's a really cool ingredient. It's called the earth apple down in Peru. And it's somewhat akin to jicama, but has a much more of a ginger kind of flavor, very juicy, keeps extremely well. But from a health perspective, it's been used for centuries in Peru to help treat diabetes because it's a true what they call a fructooligosaccharide. Oh. So the sugar, you know, it's like one on the glycemic index scale. So you can eat it. It's very sweet. You can make a syrup out of it. I tend to like it in salads, in fresh salads, because it's just crunchy and gingery and sweet. Yeah, you can have it raw. Absolutely delicious.
Wow, that sounds great. It sounds like a magical food. Does it really exist?
It does. Oh, yeah. Oh, and this is part of what Peru has to offer. It's like it's really cool.
Which farm is that?
It's called Peace Seedlings. Okay. And it's down Corvallis. It's a seed farm for the most part, but they have some acreage, and they're really into this type of stuff. And they've been very like I said, diligent about figuring out how to do this here in Oregon, and they've succeeded. So it's really cool.
That's great.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, definitely we're going to have a field trip there.
Yes. There you go.
Can I come?
Yeah.
Well, thanks, you guys. Thank you, Peter Platt, who serves on the boards of the Hacienda Community Development Corporation and the Oregon Food Bank when he is not running the nationally acclaimed restaurant Andina. Thank you, Hannah Wallace, contributing writer at Civil Eats, who covers food, wine, sustainability, and travel for many national publications. And thank you, Roxy De La Torre. I'm so glad that OPB stole you away from Univision so I got to meet you and get you on the show. It's been really fun to have you here.
Thank you.
Hey, folks, we want you to savor the conversation with us. Help other folks find our show by subscribing to and rating The Four Top on iTunes, NPR One, Stitcher, or however you get your podcasts. It only takes a few seconds, and it helps us so much. At facebook.com/TheFourTop, you can suggest topics for us to discuss. And tweet us, please, at @TheFourTop, all one word. Today's IACP award-winning, James Beard Award-nominated show was recorded in the high-fiber, protein-packed city of Portland, Oregon, in the studios of OPB. You can read all about us on the OPB website. Our producer is Alex Ward. Special thanks to OPB sound supervisor Stephen Cray. And our theme music was performed by the incomparable wine importer Kermit Lynch. I hope you can all join us for our next episode, and please tell your friends about The Four Top. Adios! Nuit blanche, nuit blanche, nuit
blanche. Bueno, ¿quién va a correr con el cheque?
Pues yo creo que...
¿Yo?
El caballero deja la propina.
No. Te ofrecí almuerzo la última vez que visitaste Andina.
Bueno, ya, yo pago la propina.
Ah, ok, bueno, la propina ya.